On this week's 51%, the Supreme Court has dismissed an appeal of a strict abortion ban in Idaho, allowing emergency abortions in the state to continue, for now. We speak with Rutgers Law School professor Kimberly Mutcherson about what this means for patients in Idaho and for the court.
What we saw in this case is what we expect a lot more of, right? Which is incredible fractions, incredible factions that are created within the court, and the people who pay the price for that are people who are seeking abortion care in this country.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. Just a couple weeks after it turned back a challenge of the Food and Drug Administration's regulations for mifepristone, the Supreme Court has ruled on another case involving abortion rights, this time from Idaho. The court was divided 6-3 as it dismissed an appeal over a strict abortion ban in the state, reinstating a lower court ruling allowing emergency abortions, cases in which abortion is used to protect the life of the mother or the health of the mother, to continue, at least for now. The case still faces further litigation in the lower courts before it will likely find its way back to the Supreme Court's door. Kimberly Mutcherson spoke with me on the day of the decision to help us break it all down. She's a returning guest on this show, so if you're a frequent listener, you may be familiar with her voice. Mutcherson is a professor and former co-dean at Rutgers Law School in Camden, New Jersey, where her work has largely focused on family and health law, bioethics, and reproductive justice. She says at the heart of this case is the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, or EMTALA.
EMTALA is a federal statute that was passed many, many years ago, and it was really passed to prevent patient dumping. And the idea was, you know, this was during a time where you were hearing horrible stories about, you know, folks showing up to an emergency room and the hospitals finding out that they didn't have insurance and sort of, you know, putting them in a wheelchair and pushing them out to a bus stop and dropping them there, which is obviously not the kind of care that we want people to be getting in this country. And so the idea of EMTALA was to require hospitals that receive federal funding, which is basically all hospitals, because they all take Medicaid of some sort, that they have to stabilize a patient who shows up in their emergency room before they can transfer that patient. So the conflict that arises here is that in our post-Dobbs world, the Department of Health and Human Services issued a guidance about abortion and EMTALA. And what they said in that guidance is that even if a state law bans abortion, that a state has to provide abortions under EMTALA if there is a set of circumstances and a set of emergency circumstances where an abortion is going to be stabilizing treatment for a pregnant person. And Idaho said, absolutely not. Idaho said, we have a state abortion law, and our state abortion law only allows abortions to happen when there is a risk to the life of the mother, and to the extent that EMTALA would allow abortions to take place when there's a risk to the health of the mother. So, for instance, you're going to lose your fertility if you don't have a pregnancy termination. Idaho says, we don't want abortions to happen in those circumstances. We only want abortions in what we consider to be the most dire of circumstances. And so that's where the conflict is, and that's how we ended up at the Supreme Court.
So the Department of Justice challenged that ban in Idaho, and that's what brought us here.
Yeah, that's right. So the Department of Justice came in to defend the position that the government had taken here. Down below, they won, basically, which means that they were able to get a preliminary injunction, which said that Idaho could not enforce this statute to the extent that it conflicted with EMTALA while they were still going through the process of the lawsuit. That ultimately ended up at the Supreme Court. And for about 5 months, the Supreme Court did not enforce that preliminary injunction. So essentially said, Idaho, you can keep enforcing your law as you want to while we try to figure this out. And then they, you know, released this opinion today. I was going to say yesterday. Today was the official. You know, they released this opinion today that says basically we took this case too soon. We're going to send it back down and let the process play itself out in the trial court and the appellate court. And then if it's appropriate for it to come back to us, we can think about whether we take it back again at that point. So that could be months from now. That could be a year from now. Who knows?
Okay, so let's get into the Supreme Court's reasoning for saying, you know, we jumped the gun, we took this case too soon. What's the opinion of the court?
So there are multiple opinions that came out. There's an opinion by Justice Barrett that is joined by Justice Kavanaugh and Chief Justice Roberts. There's an opinion by Justice Kagan that is joined by Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor. There's an opinion by Justice Jackson writing on her own. And then there's an opinion that is written by Justice Alito and Justice, also Justice Thomas agrees with all of that opinion, and Justice Gorsuch agrees with some of that opinion. So there are a number of different positions that are being articulated here. So one position, which is the Amy Comey Barrett position, is basically, you know, we took this case and now all these sort of things have changed. The government's position has changed on some of the issues. Idaho's position has changed on some of the issues. The Idaho Supreme Court has weighed in about how to interpret their abortion law. And so now it makes sense to send it back down to the district court to really have a fulsome discussion of what's going on here and then bring it back to the Supreme Court if necessary. Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson basically are saying, we've got what we need here, right? We've had oral argument, we've had amici briefs from 40 plus different organizations weighing in, both those who are supporting Idaho and those who are supporting the government's position. We have all of this information. We're in a position where we should make a decision here. And then Justice Jackson wrote even more forcefully to say, essentially, the Supreme Court is just kicking the can down the road. And while they're kicking the can down the road, there are people in other parts of the country, right? So if you're in Idaho, you're sort of protected at this point because the preliminary injunction is back in force. But Texas has done something very similar in terms of, you know, asserting that their abortion law is supreme to EMTALA, and nothing that was decided today has an impact on what Texas has done. So, you know, Justice Jackson is basically saying this is an issue that needs to be sorted out. It's a very big issue. We have all the information that we need, and we should move forward. And then the last trio of justices, you know, written in an opinion written by Justice Alito, they basically also say, you know, we should be able to decide this now. But their position is it's so clear that the government is wrong here that we should be able to decide it in favor of Idaho. So it's really a reflection of how deeply divided this court continues to be. You know, there was something very surprising about the Mifepristone case where you had a decision that was a unanimous decision, which is, I mean, in an abortion case, it's kind of totally unexpected at this point. But what we saw in this case is what we expect a lot more of, right? Which is incredible fractions, incredible factions that are created within the court. And the people who pay the price for that are people who are seeking abortion care in this country.
You mentioned the Mifepristone case, and we discussed that case on last week's show. It essentially turned back a challenge of the FDA's approval and regulations for Mifepristone, which is commonly used in medication abortions. But in doing so, it didn't really get to the heart of the argument in that challenge. It kind of just dismissed the case on a technicality, saying that, you know, it should have never been brought up in the first place. And so it seems like we've got multiple cases now where the court is kind of ruling on abortion, but not really ruling on abortion. Do you feel this has anything to do with the fact that, you know, we're 2 years out from Dobbs and there's a lot of animosity toward the court right now because of that case? And it's also an election year where abortion is going to be a major issue and it's going to be more commonly discussed. You know, I think in one of our previous conversations, you mentioned that perhaps the court was hoping to wash its hands of abortion as an issue with Dobbs, but clearly that's not the case.
Yeah. You know, I think that's a really interesting question, because if you talk to the justices on the court, they will, of course, say, you know, we are not a political branch. You know, our job is not to be impacted by an election cycle. Our job is not to be impacted by, you know, public opinion. You know, our job is to objectively understand the Constitution and articulate the rights that are available to folks under that Constitution. I think you'd be really hard pressed to find any substantial number of people who believe that the Supreme Court is not a political institution. Even if they did believe it at some point, I don't think they could, in good faith, say that they believe that now. So, you know, I'm not going to speculate about whether they're worried about the presidential election or sort of what might be going on there. But I certainly think there's a real battle going on in terms of the power of the court, in terms of the legitimacy of the court, which is something I think that Chief Justice Roberts really cares about, and he's kind of lost the thread on that. And so I think we're going to continue to see these decisions that, whether it's in abortion or whether it's in gun control or, you know, lots of other really important issues, these decisions that show that there's an incredible schism within the court, and that we are going to be seeing these kinds of difficult, painful decisions for many, many years to come.
You mentioned earlier that you initially wanted to say that this decision came out yesterday. We're speaking on the day that the court officially released the decision, but it did appear to leak last night, which of course is not something that is usual for the court. You know, the only time that I can think of it that comes to mind is Dobbs 2 years ago, but it doesn't necessarily look like it's the same kind of situation.
Yes, it is very unusual. I think that because of the very unprecedented and the very unusual leak when before Dobbs came out, and that was very different, right? Because that wasn't, I mean, for in this situation, you could say, oh, maybe somebody just got the schedule wrong, and so they uploaded it, and then they were like, oh my gosh, that one's not supposed to come out today, and they, you know, immediately took it back down. Whereas with the Dobbs leak, I mean, it was pretty clear that somebody who had access to that opinion was what just wanted it to be out into the world early. And of course, there's been all sorts of speculation about why somebody would have wanted that. So this feels more like a technical error, whereas what happened with Dobbs felt really deliberate.
So this dismissal means emergency abortions in Idaho are allowed to resume for now. What does this mean for potential patients in that state?
So, you know, part of what changed, you know, according to Justice Barrett and the other folks who signed on to her opinion, part of what changed between when they granted cert to try to sort some of these issues out and the opinion today is that in the oral argument and in other instances, Idaho had suddenly had an interpretation of the law that they claimed was not out of sync with EMTALA at all. So they basically said everything that the government says is a set of circumstances that involve the health of a pregnant person that you would be allowed to perform an abortion in Idaho for all of those conditions, which is not something that they had articulated before. So if you talk to folks in Idaho, they will say that the law that we have is completely in line with EMTALA, and so anybody who needs emergency abortion care in Idaho because there is a risk to their life is going to have access to that care. I think what's very clear, and this is the point that Justice Jackson made in her opinion in Moyle today, is whatever the Idaho attorneys said in the Supreme Court is not going to be reassuring for healthcare providers on the ground in Idaho, right? So when you perform an abortion because you think it's the right set of circumstances, and then you get hauled into criminal court and you're freedom is at risk, and your license to practice medicine is also at risk. And you say, well, this is what they said in the oral argument at the Supreme Court, that isn't necessarily going to protect you. And so the upshot of that is that folks in Idaho who are providing care, right, these healthcare providers who part of what they put on the table is that they have been airlifting women and pregnant patients out of Idaho to get care that normally they would have been able to have access to, but they can't because they're not quite sure what Idaho's law is going to protect and what Idaho's law is not going to protect. And so I think that we're really in a position where things are still going to be really difficult in Idaho because people whose livelihoods and whose freedom are on the line, and I'm talking here about healthcare providers, are not in a position where they feel like they have sufficient clarity and sufficient protection under EMTALA to perform abortions in circumstances where they cannot say with medical certainty that this is a patient who is going to die if I don't perform this abortion. So if you say this is a patient who's going to lose her uterus if I don't perform this abortion, Idaho law doesn't say that that is a set of circumstances in which you are allowed to perform an abortion. So I think what it means for emergency medical care is that we're still in a place where it's not clear what's going to be available. And we're still in a place where there are patients who are often going through one of the most difficult times in their lives, right? Often we're talking about folks who have wanted pregnancies and who are miscarrying or having other sorts of complications. And to, you know, have that going on, and then on top of that, have a physician say to you, I would want to perform an abortion right now, but I'm not sure that the law allows me to. So we're either going to have to wait till you get a little bit sicker, or we're just going to fly you out to another state, in order to get that care. And that's just not fair for anybody to be put in that position, whether it's a healthcare provider, and certainly not fair for the pregnant person.
Well, Kimberly, thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything that we haven't touched on about this case that you want to make sure people know?
So this EMTALA case is not just about Idaho. This EMTALA case is fundamentally about at least two issues, right? One issue is the general issue of when does federal law preempt state law? And we have a whole supremacy clause in our Constitution that says where the federal government has legislated in a particular area, and state law conflicts with that, that the federal government wins. I mean, that is literally con law 101. So to say that that is not the case when it comes to abortion, one is a way of exceptionalizing abortion, which we have done in this country for a very long time. And that puts people at risk and that steals their autonomy. But it also has larger implications for the relationship between the federal government and states. This is really shifting a balance in a pretty substantial way. And just because it happens in the context of abortion right here doesn't mean that when another issue comes along, it won't happen in that context as well. So there's a very specific issues related to abortion here, but there are these broader issues related to federalism that are also on the table in this case.
Kimberly Mutcherson is a professor of law and former co-dean at Rutgers Law School in Camden, New Jersey, where her work has largely focused on reproductive justice, bioethics, and family and health law. Kimberly, thanks for taking the time.
Sure, happy to talk to you.
Monday, June 24th, was the second anniversary of Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, the Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade and ended constitutional protection for abortion in the U.S. To mark the anniversary, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey announced she had signed an executive order reaffirming the state's protections for abortion access. WAMC's James Polyoligopoulos brings us more.
Today is really about making clear that women's rights, the freedom of choice, the freedom of reproductive choice is non-negotiable here in Massachusetts. We will protect it. We will defend it.
Healey's executive order directs personnel under the governor's authority to reaffirm and recognize state laws protecting abortion rights. It also instructs the state commissioner of public health to issue guidance to hospitals that, as a condition of licensure in Massachusetts, all hospitals must comply with all applicable state and federal statutes and regulations in abortion access and care. The commissioner, Dr. Robbie Goldstein, reiterated the penalties for failing to provide said care.
Failure of a hospital or a provider to provide abortion care to preserve the life of a pregnant person or to prevent risk of serious harm is a violation of state statutes and regulations and federal requirements, and it will result in disciplinary action.
The Division of Insurance was also tasked with issuing a bulletin to insurers, identifying the state's expectations regarding carrier requirements to provide coverage for abortion and abortion-related care, according to Healey's office. Reporting from Springfield, this is James Polyoligopoulos at WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
I think generally no one wants to be in court, except maybe for our next guest. And the family court system can be especially difficult and stressful to navigate. June 25th was primary day in New York, and in the Capital Region, three women won the Democratic race for three family court judge seats in Albany County. One of them was Jillian Faison, an attorney with the Albany County District Attorney's Office, handling cases involving juvenile delinquency. Our associate producer, Jody Cowan, recently spoke with Faison to learn more about family courts in New York.
Can you break down a little bit how family court fits into the current New York court structure?
Sure. So family court is a civil court. Could be said it's a problem-solving court, and people can bring a petition asking for the court's intervention in a custody matter, deciding who has physical custody, who has legal custody of a child under the age of 18, and there's also petitions that are brought by the county alleging juvenile delinquency. That is, like I said, not a criminal action. It's an adjudication. So technically, for young people that have juvenile delinquency issues, if they are able to avoid those issues as an adult, they don't have to report that on a job application or a housing application. It is not a criminal conviction. So family court also deals with what's called family offenses, and those are a handful of crimes where instead of going to the criminal court, you can go to family court and ask for an order of protection. You can ask for other remedies via a term of probation for the offender, and it's for family members, intimate partners, where you want something done about the underlying situation, but you don't want to go to criminal court. There's also abuse and neglect. That's a petition that the county can bring when there's an allegation that a person legally responsible for a child has either abused or neglected that child. There's adoptions that happen. It's the happiest day at family court. It's adoption day. It happens twice a year. Adoptions happen all the time, but there are two particular events, celebrations that they have down at family court. It's wonderful to see. And child support happens down at family court, paternity. And those are the major kinds of actions that happen down at family court.
And in New York State, there's a family court for each county.
That's right.
I was curious when kind of researching some of this, if there was a legal definition of family and what that might mean today in 2024.
So in family court, depending on what kind of proceeding you are in, the definition, it's not necessarily a family, but there's a definition of intimate partner such that you couldn't bring a family offense petition against someone that you're not in a relationship with, that you're not a family member of, that you're not in their household. That wouldn't qualify. For abuse and neglect cases, it's person legally responsible. So it does not have to be your mother, your father, you know, a grandparent that is legally responsible for you, or it's, you know, a babysitter that is constantly caring for a child and could be found as a person legally responsible for a young person, depending on how much time they spend with that youth. In custody, it is the biological parents where you start, but in certain circumstances, it has to be shown extraordinary circumstances to overcome the presumption that custody would be with a parent or someone that has legal guardianship. So you have a definition of a person legally responsible. You have the definition of an intimate partner or family member in terms of what the guidelines are as to who you can bring a petition about in family court.
What are families up against? That you've done a lot of work with both parents and with children and family groups. What is it that families are facing ahead of family court or just in general?
Well, there are so many things that families are facing. And, you know, the first of which I would say is poverty. There are serious problems with food insecurity, with housing insecurity, and that really destabilize and bring chaos into the lives of families. And you have situations where a family may be accused of educational neglect because they're struggling to get a kid to school on time and consistently. But the underlying reasons for that are rooted in poverty and housing instability. You could have a situation where a child is removed or at risk of being removed because the housing situation is unlivable. You know, dirty house is an allegation that can be put forward in a neglect petition. The fact that there is no heat or hot water in the house could potentially be part of a neglect petition. Inadequate food could also be part of a neglect petition. And so those are issues that are rooted in poverty. Mental health is also a huge piece of what families are facing, of what, you know, we as a society, right? Because what is a society if not the families that make it up? And, you know, people do say, show me a society that treats its children well, and I'll show you a strong society. But the, I think, left out part of that statement is that you can't help a child unless you are willing to help their family. These kids do not exist in a vacuum. They exist as part of a family structure, as part of a community. And if you're not willing to help that family, how is it that you're supposed to help the child? So that's some small, description of what families are facing.
When looking at families in distress, is there steps to take to maybe address when it's the best time to bring family court into the situation?
So I would say that the bright line is, you know, a substantial risk of harm. So if there is potential violence or potential harm that could come to a child or a person, then by all means, petition the court. But sometimes, and I tell my clients this a lot, mediation is something that is an option for families, specifically in custody matters, where you just need a third party to help to create a path for conversation and consensus between two parents to decide how is this parenting schedule going to look. It does not have to be the family court judge. And really, it shouldn't be the family court judge because each parent knows better than anyone else, right? How, when, and where the parenting schedule should look. But mediation is a great resource. In Albany County, it's Mediation Matters is the name of the nonprofit. But there is a contract for mediation in every county in the state of New York. So no matter where you are in New York State, you can access a mediation provider. I believe that's paid for through the Office of Court Administration to try to take some of the burden off of the courts where, you know, you really don't need a judge making the decisions.
How can children be best informed of their rights within the family court system, especially when maybe sometimes the child is kind of like the last informed of the process here?
Well, it depends on what kind of matter we're talking about. The child does get an attorney that will explain to the child what their rights are and what the proceeding is going to look like, depending on what their age is, how appropriate it is to get into the weeds with that process. Similarly, as a juvenile justice matter, you have an attorney, and that attorney, it's their duty to explain to the young person what the process is, what their rights are, and what to expect out of the case. And so there are a lot of professionals whose job it is to educate children because they represent them, and that's part of that representation.
You are just one of five Democrats running for three family court judge seats in Albany County at this month's primary, and you won. Given your background and experience, how do you envision taking on this role?
So I have been at many, many seats at the table in terms of child welfare. So I was with the county attorney's office. I was with the Office of Children and Family Services doing the public policy for the state of New York in that space. And now I'm with the private representation as an attorney for the child. So I feel like I've had the unique opportunity to see these issues from so many different angles that I'm really well informed to then preside over those cases and be the final say in what happens in a case. So I think that each case is different. Each case brought in family court is intensely unique in its facets. But I think that with my time and my experience in family court, I realized that you have to listen. You have to be compassionate because families are really struggling and going through very challenging times when they're coming to family court. And, you know, there's sometimes where you just have to let them, meaning the litigants, decide for themselves how the resolution is going to look. And other times it goes to trial and you are the final arbiter. But you have to be ready to listen. But you also could, and I will, be creative in solutions and problem solving, thinking outside the box of what may actually help a family, what may, you know, be useful and truly resolve whatever the issues are. And I'm just really excited to bring that energy and that perspective to the bench.
That was our associate producer, Jody Cowan, speaking with Jillian Faison, an attorney with the Albany County District Attorney's Office. On June 25th, Faison and two other women won the Democratic primary for three family court judge seats in Albany County. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcasts.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King from 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. light air down the hallway. I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete. Sweet bells in little.